2015, Supreme Court passed its Obergefell versus Hodges decision with a one-vote margin, striking down all the laws establishing marriage as exclusively between a man and a woman. In a dissenting opinion commenting on that decision, Justice Antonin Scalia wrote that the court's decision was, quote, a threat to American democracy. The Obergefell ruling, Scalia continued, says that my ruler, again a direct quote, and the ruler of 320 million Americans coast to coast is a majority of the 9 lawyers on the Supreme Court, 4 of whom, he later remarked, lived in New York City. As Justice Scalia indicated, the Obergefell decision was part of a concerted attack on both the moral order and representative government in the United States in general, and the state of Indiana in particular. These two issues, morality and democracy, are intimately related because, as John Adams, one of America's founding fathers, said, we have no constitution that functions in the absence of a moral people. In order to destroy the American form of government, the Cultural Revolutionaries had to first undermine America's understanding of morality, because only morality guarantees the freedom necessary for self-government. Unlike Aristotle, who argued that men were slaves, phusei, which is to say by nature, St. Augustine took a radically moral view of the issue. Man was free as long as he was moral, which is to say acting according to the dictates of practical reason. It is clear, he wrote in The City of God, that sin is the primary cause of servitude. That means, he continued in another passage from the same book, that a good man, though a slave, is free, but a wicked man, though a king, is a slave, for he serves not one man alone, but is what is worse, as many masters as he has vices. This, I said in another context, is the foundation of the regime that we now live under, which is the opposite of the of Christian culture that was created when during the thousand-year reign after the fall of Rome. The Christian says, if you want to be free, be moral. The anti-Christian government of Antichrist that begins, you can name it, maybe with the French Revolution, but we have various categories, takes that and turns it upside down, turns it on its head, which is basically, if you want to maintain political control, promote vice. And that's the story of our culture right now. America rules the way Satan rules. That's why the Iranians call it the Great Satan. It rules by moral corruption, and it spreads this moral corruption throughout the entire world under the pretext of spreading or concern about human rights. And so when Obama goes to Kenya, what does he talk about? He lectures those people on human rights, which means the right to sodomy or the right to abortion. Man is a rational creature, okay, which means he has to follow the dictates of practical reason. So there can be no right to something that is morally wrong. That's impossible, and this is the sleight of hand that is now being used to deprive us of our government, our representative government. And I say this because I watched it happen firsthand in the state of Indiana. I don't know those of you who are not as fortunate as I am living in the state of Indiana may not have noticed that during March of this year, our state was vilified by the entire nation because it had passed something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The citizens of the government legislature had passed this law. This law stated simply that people should not be coerced into participating in gay weddings if it violated their conscience. This outraged a particularly influential group of people in the United States. It also, the governor of Indiana by the name of Mike Pence is a Republican, He was totally befuddled. He did not understand the way warfare is conducted in our age. As I said before, it's not guys in red uniforms firing cannons at guys in blue uniforms anymore. It's going to be about human rights or homosexual discrimination. And so when Mike Pence went on Meet the Press, he looked like a deer caught in the headlights. He's a Republican. And the reason he was so befuddled is because the revolutionaries in this instance were a cabal of three different groups of people. The CEOs. Republicans are supposed to be, they stand for the CEOs. That's their party, right? So why are they doing this? The homosexuals and the Jews. What do these three groups have in common? They're all minorities. The 1% on Wall Street became famous. Homosexuals are between 1% and 2%, any accurate indication, and Jews are always a minority in any culture where they live. What do they have in common? They have enormous political and media and financial power. And so what is their main problem? How do you get to impose your views on everyone else when the official explanation is that we live in a democracy? How do you do this? Well, you do this by by talking about human rights and by talking about the morality of human rights. The net result is tyranny. In an article which appeared in First Things, a Notre Dame professor, Patrick J. Deneen, wrote, "What we saw in Indiana was not just a miscalculation by Republicans. We saw fully unmasked just who runs America and the kind of America that they are bringing more fully into reality every passing day. It will be an America where the powerful will govern completely over the powerless, where the rich dictate terms to the poor, where the strong are unleashed from the old restraints of culture and place, where libertarian indifference, whether in respect to economic inequality or morals, is inscribed into the national fabric, and where the unburdened hedonic human will reigns ascendant." That's the world we're facing now. We're talking about successful revolutions where the communists failed. If the communists had showed up in Indiana and said, we're going to rewrite your laws, well, who would have gone along with it? The Republican governor? No. But a CEO parachutes in from San Francisco and they welcome him with open arms. Who gave this guy the right to rewrite the laws of the state of Indiana? Nobody can answer that question. I've asked one politician after another. They can't answer that question. He doesn't live in Indiana. Nobody elected him. We elected a certain group of people, and they were completely ignored by this revolutionary cabal that is now the ruling coalition in the United States. It's not just the United States. The Rifer coup d'etat employed the same modus operandi as the one which Victoria Nuland orchestrated in the Ukraine in February of last year, which was in turn a replay of all of the so-called color revolutions which the CIA used to take control of the southern tier of former Soviet republics during the years following the fall of communism. What happened in Indiana during Holy Week was also followed the pattern of the failed coup d'etat in Iran in 2009, when the CIA, the National Endowment for Democracy, and a host of other NGO fronts for covert warfare tried to overturn that year's election. There's even a movie about it. It's called Rosewater. John Stewart is the director of that movie. You can see what they did just by looking at that movie. Marx's contention that history repeats itself, first as tragedy and then as farce, finds easy substantiation if we compare the two catalyzing events of the respective coups in Iran and Indiana. In Iran in 2009, we had the tragic death of Neda Sultan. In Indiana in 2015, we had the story of Memories Pizza. Remember Memories Pizza? It's a pizzeria in Walkerton, Indiana. You've never heard of Walkerton, Indiana. It has 2,000 people, The local TV stations in South Bend sent out their helicopter gunships, and they found a pizzeria in Walkerton, Indiana, where the lady says, no, we wouldn't cater to a gay wedding. And all hell broke loose at that point. Both of these things were media-confected events used to justify their various respective media-orchestrated color revolutions. Both the CIA, both the coup in Indiana and the coup in Iran had a common source in the CIA's psychological and doctrinal warfare programs, which became operative in 1953. In other words, before we can understand what is happening in 2015, and we have to go back and understand what happened in that pivotal year in which the CIA took over the White House and inaugurated the era of psychological warfare by staging the coup d'etat which toppled Mossadegh and put the Shah on the peacock throne. 1953 was also the year in which the CIA launched this doctrinal warfare program against the Catholic Church. The program was created by a professor from Georgetown University by the name of Edward Lilly, but its main implementers were Henry Luce, the publisher and founder of Time magazine, John Courtney Murray, the Jesuit who advised Luce on Catholic matters, and C.D. Jackson, the CIA agent, who was the agency's liaison with Time Life, the publishing empire. Beginning in 1963, Murray, Luce, and Jackson used the CIA's doctrinal warfare program to disrupt the Second Vatican Council and turn it into what Pope Benedict would later call the Council of the Media. Church documents, no matter what they actually said, were transformed by being refracted through the lens of Time magazine articles. Murray continued the psychological warfare campaign by writing the notes to the Abbott edition translation of Dignitatis Humanae. Those notes gave the impression that the Catholic Church now accepted the American version of religious liberty and the separation of church and state. 1965 was the year in which the Second Vatican Council ended. It was also the year in which the Catholic Church abandoned the traditional teaching on the relationship with church between church and state, no matter what Dignitatis Humanae said. Instead of claiming, as Pope Leo XIII had, that the church was to the state what the soul was to the body, the church now accepted the American separation of church and state as something not just to be tolerated, but something good in itself. The results of that decision have been disastrous for both the church and the world. The Catholic Church has lost every single battle in the culture wars for 50 years now. Beginning with the collapse of the Legion of Decency, which took place in 65, when Hollywood produced The Pawnbroker, and Griswold versus Connecticut, which Michael has already adverted to, the decision decriminalizing the sale of contraceptives. The church has suffered one defeat after another, culminating in the recent Obergefell decision striking down every law which specified that marriage had to take place between a man and a woman. The church has failed consistently for the past 50 years because she has been intellectually crippled by a set of bad ideas that ensures failure. The main bad idea at the heart of this problem is religious freedom, and the architect of that bad idea was John Courtney Murray. Everyone knew that John Courtney Murray had something to do with the redefinition of the Catholic position on religious freedom. Everyone knew that he wrote the notes for the Abbott edition of Dignitatis Humanae, which fundamentally distorted the meaning of that document. What no one knew until now, with the publication of this book, is the extent of Murray's collaboration with Henry Luce, Time Life, and the CIA in crippling the Catholic Church by imposing upon it a false understanding of religious liberty. Murray's distortion of Dignitatis Humanae was even more devastating for Europe, where many nations had granted the Catholic Church special status as its established religion. 1975 was the year that Franco died. After his death, the CIA's doctrinal warfare program was used to destroy the moral and social order in Spain. Spain is a classic instance of what happens when a Catholic country accepts the American proposition. By 2015, Spain had accepted fast-track divorce, legalized abortion, and sanctioned homosexual unions. As if that weren't bad enough, the Spanish embrace of the American economic libertarianism had done nothing to improve economic inequalities in Spain, which have only grown larger in recent years. 1975 was a crucial year in other regards as well, because it was in this year that the ideology behind the Obergefell decision was created. It was created by a Frenchman. 1975 was the year in which Discipline and Punish rolled off the presses in France. Its author was a homosexual professor by the name of Michel Foucault. L'Express, the French version of Time magazine, had anointed Foucault as Sartre's heir apparent and France's new philosopher king in 1966 as part of the run-up to the Revolution of May of 1968, whose purpose was to depose Charles de Gaulle, who was a Catholic and as such antagonistic to the spread of American influence in Europe. In a way that would prove uncannily prescient of his own demise, Foucault invariably connected the bathhouse experience, which he experienced when he went to San Francisco in 1975, and death. "Complete total pleasure for me is related to death," he said. What he failed to see was how his absorption into that lifestyle brought about the death of the movement he had been neglected to lead. As the left in Europe careened toward terrorism, Foucault drifted off in the opposite direction and took the majority of its members with him. By succumbing to the increasingly insistent pull of his own homosexual compulsions, Foucault, according to his biographer, made a kind of Faustian pact with the death instinct and the hecatombs of fascist adventure. Foucault is less oblique in describing his own personal deal with the devil, which he did in Death Valley, 1975, Zabriskie Point, after taking LSD. This is what he said about it. "The Faustian pact," he called it that, that's his term, "whose temptation has been instilled in us by the deployment of sexuality, is now as follows. To exchange life in its entirety for sex itself. For the truth and sovereignty of sex. Sex is worth dying for. It is in this strictly historical sense that sex is indeed imbued with the death instinct." Well, you have to say one thing about Foucault. He followed his own principles. He died of AIDS in 1984 after spending a decade in the bathhouses of San Francisco. Before he died, he gave birth to the homosexual movement. Within weeks of what he just said, gay activists had formed a new organization, the Gay Liberation Front, a revolutionary homosexual group of men and women formed with the realization that complete liberation of all people cannot come about unless existing social conditions are abolished. The GLF declared in its founding manifesto, "We reject society's attempts to impose sexual roles and definitions on our nature." What we're seeing here is the changing of the guard. I talked about the Black Jewish Alliance. The Black Jewish Alliance blew up, depending on how you want to talk about it, in 1967 with the publication of Harold Cruz's book, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. Cruz was a professor of Black Studies at the University of Michigan. He was a communist. He was in the Communist Party cell at Harlem. And he wrote in his book that basically everything the blacks wanted to do, or every black organization was controlled by Jews who used the blacks to foster their agenda. Once he said this, the whole thing blew up. Or you could say it blew up in 1969 when the Black Panthers got murdered in Chicago, something I already discussed here. What also happened in 1969 was something that's called the Stonewall Riots. Stonewall Inn was a gay bar in Greenwich Village. When the police raided it, the homosexuals staged a riot and started throwing rocks at the police, and now this is dated as the beginning of the homosexual movement. What you're seeing here is the changing of the guard, okay? At this point, the black is no longer a reliable revolutionary, and so the Jews who supported that all got out of that movement, and they found a new revolutionary avant-garde, and that new revolutionary avant-garde is the homosexual. And the homosexual movement is the direct descendant of the black civil rights movement, the black revolutionary movement, and it's sponsored by the same people. Now, does that, by the same people, I mean the Jews. Now, if you say that, you will be called an anti-Semite. Because anytime anyone, any goy, criticizes a Jew, he's known as an anti-Semite. This has no place in the Catholic faith. Okay, this is not part, you don't have to go to confession every time you say the word Jew. You don't have to go to confession every time you criticize a Jew. Moses criticized Jews. Was he an anti-Semite? Jesus Christ criticized Jews. Was he an anti-Semite? No. You're not an anti-Semite if you criticize Jews. You are not saying that they are condemned to evil behavior because of their DNA. That's what anti-Semitism is, and no Catholic believes in it. No Catholic ever believed in that. Not in the Middle Ages, never. It was an anti-Catholic movement. The guy who created it was a German by the name of Wilhelm Marr. So you will be criticized if you say that the Jews are behind the homosexual movement, but it just so happens that on May 21st, 2013, Vice President Joseph Biden said the same thing. He praised, this is a direct quote, he praised Jewish leaders in the media, crediting them with helping change American attitudes on gay marriage. In a speech at the Democratic National Convention celebrating Jewish Heritage Month, Biden claimed that Jews were responsible for changing people's attitudes. It wasn't anything we legislatively did. It was will and grace, said Biden, referring to an NBC sitcom that went off the air 9 years ago. It was the social media, literally. That's what changed people's attitudes. That's why I was so certain that the vast majority of people would embrace and rapidly embrace gay marriage. I bet you 85% of those changes, whether it's in Hollywood or social media, are a consequence of Jewish leaders in the industry. The influence is immense. The influence is immense, and I might add, it's all to the good. And because he said that, and because he's vice president, he got a pass. If you say it, you'll be called an anti-Semite. Same statement. As if that weren't enough, the liberal Jewish magazine Tikkun agreed with Vice President Biden's assessment. As Amy Dean put it, in a few short years, same-sex marriage went from being an untouchable political hot potato to a broadly accepted civil right in 18 states in the District of Columbia. Jews and their social justice organizations helped make that happen. In fact, this magazine was a prophetic voice of marriage equality, supporting same-sex unions in the early 1990s and helping to lay the groundwork for a current wave of victories. So how does this work? How does this work? First of all, Indiana is a colony of the United States of America. The colonial rulers live on the East Coast and the West Coast. Whenever somebody in Indiana acts up in a way that they find reprehensible, they descend on you and they say, you're wrong. You're an immoral person. What we're talking about here is the transvaluation of values that Nietzsche talked about. They are the people who know what the real moral law is, and you don't. And so they'll do things like, oh, you named your team the Redskins. Don't you know that's bad? And people are stunned. They think, gosh, I didn't know that. Why is it bad? Well, don't you know? I mean, this is offensive to, well, offensive to whom? I kind of like Redskins. That's why we named it. We want to imitate them, you know? They were fierce. We want to be fierce, you know? No, what happens here is that the moral order is changed. And now you are wrong, and when you're in error, error has no rights. And so you have no rights anymore, and that's precisely what happened in the state of Indiana. We lost our rights. We lost our government, and now we are being ruled by a cabal of CEOs and homosexuals, and they're Jewish promoters. What's the antidote to this? The antidote to this is the moral law. We have to be firm in asserting the moral law. Okay, that's the first thing. But the church is going to also have to get back to reasserting the traditional teaching on church and state, which Michael ably quoted to you from that encyclical. The point here is, if you look at the view of world history, you realize that God cannot tolerate a vacuum in this regard. So if the church drops the ball, now I'm not saying that Dignitatis Humanae is the truth. It is the true church teaching. It doesn't matter. Because Time Life, the CIA, and John Courtney Murray took it over and commandeered. Everybody believed them and nobody believed the church anymore. When Pope John Paul II came to Philadelphia in 1979, he re-articulated chapter and verse, the traditional church teaching from Dignitatis Humanae, and everybody ignored him. Nothing changed. So God does not tolerate a vacuum. And God is the author of human history. And we have free will. I'm not denying that we have free will. But we are functioning in an atmosphere created by God. We're on a river. You know, I row on the St. Joe River. God bless the St. Joe River. I love the St. Joe River. I love Indiana. But when you're sitting still in a boat, you're still moving because the river's moving. And that was the situation in 1979. The world spirit, what Hegel would call the zeitgeist, had enough. Enough with this materialism of both the East and the West. And so what you saw was an uprising. First in Iran with the Ayatollah Khomeini against the materialism of the West, and then 4 months later, John Paul II arrives in Warsaw and says mass at Liberty Square, an officially atheistic, communistic country, and the uprising against Soviet materialism begins. Now, these two people didn't know each other. The only contact they ever had was when John Paul II wrote to the Ayatollah and asked him to release the hostages, and the Ayatollah wrote back and told him to, in effect, to mind his own business. So they didn't get along with each other. They didn't know each other, but they were both a function of God's movement in history. So the image I like to use is a wave, and there are two surfers on the wave. It's not as if the surfers are powering themselves forward. They're both moving on the same wave. They may not know each other, and in this instance, they didn't like each other. But there was a movement in history, and I'm saying this movement in history is going on right now as we speak. As we speak, because the movement in history is the rise of consciousness. That's the only thing that history is about, because God is Logos. Logos erat Deus. That's what the Gospel of St. John says in the beginning. In Greek, he says, in ein arche ein ha Logos. In the beginning, there was Logos. This is reason. There's an order to this universe. This order is a manifestation of the mind of God. And we are privileged enough to be rational creatures so that we can apprehend that order. It's not something we do sort of by the way. This is our duty in life, to behave as we are destined to behave by rational creatures. Now, I can go now all over the world, and I can say this, and I can find people who agree with me who are not Catholic. The Muslims, the Shia in Iran, are now using the word Logos. My book has been translated into Farsi. The universities want me to come there and talk about Logos. Because why do they want to talk about Logos? Because they are troubled by the opposite of Logos, which is chaos, which is the world we live in, the world that American imperialism created in the Middle East is chaos. ISIS is chaos. And these Muslim students come to me when I'm over there, and they say, I don't understand this. How can this be Islam? How can you say chop off people's heads? Well, it's because it was the Islam that the Wahhabis supported. I mentioned this the last time about Afghanistan and the whole thing. And they're troubled by it. And I say, no, it's not. God cannot do this type of thing. And so suddenly you see this convergence now on Logos. This is the historical moment we're in right now. The Ayatollah Khomeini's triumphal return to Iran meant the return of the repressed. The very doctrine that the Catholic Church dropped, namely that the church is the soul of the state, is precisely what the Ayatollah implemented in Iran after he took power. He calls it the Veliyat Ifaki, the rule of the guardians. This is an idea that he got from Plato's Laws via Al-Farabi. It was the return of the repressed. God does not want the separation of church and state. And if the Catholics are not going to do it, he'll get Balaam's ass to articulate it. In 1979, the Iranians picked up the banner which the church had let fall in 65. History, like nature, abhors a vacuum. Islam is the scourge of God. It swept through North Africa when it was riddled with heresy. It conquered an exhausted Byzantine Empire in 1454. And in 1979, it reasserted the traditional teaching on the relationship between church and state. I gave a book tour in Poland when the Polish translation of Libido Dominandi came out. And at the end of the lecture, I said, the verdict of history is now in. The West has failed. Everybody gets upset because they believe in the West. And I said, well, it's from the Lord of the Rings. You know this is from the Lord of the Rings. It's Denethor, who's the regent. He's not the real king, but Denethor falls into despair, throws himself on the funeral pyre, and as he's throwing himself on the funeral pyre, he says, the West has failed. And then I said to the Poles, I said, but you know that's not the end of the story. And I said, what the real end of the story is that the Polish cavalry arrived after that. Of course, they'd like to hear that. They're called the Riders of Rohan in The Lord of the Rings, but it's really Jan Sobieski coming and saving Vienna. And then I said, why has the West failed? Because they abandoned Logos. What created the West? What's the difference between the West and Islam? When Ibn Rushd confronted Aristotle, he read Aristotle. He had Aristotle 200 years before Thomas Aquinas did. And Aristotle said the world was eternal, and the Quran said it was created. He didn't know how to reconcile them. How do you reconcile that? And so he said, they're both right. And that was the end of Islamic philosophy. For 1,000 years, you can't say they're both right. So what we ended up with was 5 contradictory versions of the Quran and hundreds of contradictory hadith in addition to that. And you had the death of the Islamic mind. And when you have the death of Islamic philosophy, you have the rise of the Asharites, and they are the direct descendants of the Wahhabis who taught in the madrasas of Pakistan, who are the people who inspire ISIS. Our only hope is to return to Logos. Foucault abandoned Logos. He's the philosopher that St. Paul was talking about in Romans. You abandon what can be known about God, and you end up being a man doing shameful thing to other men. That's exactly what it was. That's the genesis of this homosexual rights movement, and that's where we are right now, because we have abandoned Logos. And now we have a situation where the entire world is ready to join those who are willing to say, we are creatures of Logos. The entire world. Because they're sick of the chaos. That's the moment we live in. That's the moment we have to act on. And now the change is taking place. For the first time since the founding of the State of Israel, the power of the Israel lobby has been broken with the ratification of the agreement with Iran. What is emerging as we speak is a new global consciousness of the roles which the Jews and the CIA have played in the moral collapse of the West, as well as a new appreciation of the moral law as the only basis for global social order and world peace. Thank you.